Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all the news that's not fit to print, at least not in the New York Times or in any of the other controlled corporate mainstream papers. And it's not really fit to broadcast on Fox, CNN, MSNBC, or any of those places either, because, well, the truth is just a little too disturbing. We don't think that you can handle the truth, so we're going to feed you a bunch of pablum and myths. That's pretty much the motto of the mainstream. But here at Truth Jihad Radio, we think you can handle the truth, you need the truth, and we're going to survive as a species. We better start getting a little bit better anchored in truth, because otherwise we're going to just all dissipate off into the fog of illusion, and I think that we're going to be a very successful species if we keep going with these big lies. Well, my guest today, Ole Damgaard, is one of the great analysts of one form of a big lie, which is the false flag event, whether it's an assassination or a fake terrorist attack. There have been a huge number. Obviously, there are teams of professionals who pretty much do this for a living and fly around the world. First it's, you know, Charlie Hebdo, and then it's Copenhagen, and who knows where they're going to show up next. Maybe Italy. That's the surmise anyway. Well, Ole Damgaard has done a fantastic job investigating the Denmark shooting, that is the Copenhagen cafe shooting attributed to the usual radical Islamic suspects who really hate cartoons, just like Charlie Hebdo. Turns out, of course, it's another false flag. And we've done a couple of interviews on this, but he's got some new information and also is going to report on his speaking tour and his research tour. So bring it on, Ole Damgaard. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thank you for having me on again, Kevin.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back, and you're doing this ongoing investigation, so we need to keep checking in with you to find out what's the latest scoop. And I know we talked about the basics of this Copenhagen false flag, how it was a cafe shooting. There was an event on art, blasphemy, and free speech going on in a cafe that just happened to be like a block from a stadium, perfect staging operation area. And this event just kept on going even after the shooting happened. Supposedly they're trying to shoot through the windows and kill the guard or something outside. But the show must go on, and so this event, they went on as if nothing happened. The tape recordings of the event inside and the shooting outside, the shootings don't match up. The tape recording of what was going on inside makes no sense because they don't even really stop for this attack at all. And then there's some, you know, a crash of something on a concrete floor that couldn't have happened in that wooden-floored cafe, and so forth and so on. And this event happens exactly 1 month after Charlie Hebdo, exactly 1 month after the prediction that you made that something was going to happen in Copenhagen, and you had people out by the train station where the second part of the shooting actually happened. So you've really kind of nailed this as a very likely false flag. But it looks like you found out even more about it. So talk a little bit about the 666 newspaper issue. That sounds like one that we didn't really get into last time.
No, when I come to a crime scene, I always try to come with an open mind, so I don't have any predetermined opinions and so on, because it's so easy to start shouting false flag as soon as something happens. But in this case, once again, I think this is what we're looking at. And one of the ingredients in these false flags is that they love doing them on very specific dates. They also love using drills as one of the main elements in these false flag operations. I think the reason they have the drills there is to be able to get vehicles, explosives, extras, all of these things in place so that normal people won't notice anything. And on this specific event, the whole topic was the theme of free speech and that somebody had attacked the Muslim population by doing cartoons. Now, if you look at these things, I think we need to look at them as almost like propaganda or marketing as well, because the more times you mention, for instance, a product like Coca-Cola, if you keep repeating it, it will just go into your subconscious. And this whole thing about attacking cartoonists for having drawn cartoons of Muhammad, it's nothing new whatsoever. I would say that the first chapter was when Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini put the fatwa on Salman Rushdie, the death threat And that was for him writing the satanic verses. But the date that he actually put that fatwa was on the 14th of February, as far as I remember, 1989. That is the exact same date as when this thing took place in the cafe. And as far as I've been able to find out, the word fatwa was also used in the title of the speech, for freedom speech, on the exact same date.
Wow. So they arranged this to happen on the date. It was right next to the anniversary of the USS Maine false flag in Havana Harbor, but it was also the anniversary of the Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa on Salman Rushdie.
It was, and it was also on Valentine's Day that some of these sources use as for satanic purposes. But it was also the Valentine massacre, the mob shooting. I don't know if that is relevant in any way.
Yeah, that might be starting to wander astray.
Satanic
versus thing absolutely is relevant.
But the theme was that first it was Salman Rushdie. Then the second one was a Danish newspaper in 2000-something called Jyllandsposten that made some cartoons on Muhammad, and that made a whole global thing in media out of that. Then 2007 came the Swedish cartoonist, the Lars Vilks, where he made a cartoon, very ugly one, of Muhammad with the face of Muhammad and then the body of a dog. That is said to have had him have bodyguards ever since 2007 up until today, which I totally
This was the guy who was in the cafe, right? I mean, he was at this event.
Exactly. But then came Charlie Hebdo with the exact same theme about the cartoons, and then back to Denmark, where this Swedish cartoonist was there together with the French ambassador and other people. And
it occurs to me, Ole, that they're almost drawing these stories up like cartoons. Like, it's about cartoons, right? These blasphemous cartoons, that's the subject. But when they decide how to manufacture false flags using that theme, they sit down and storyboard it, or, you know, draw out kind of the way the story is going to unfold with the important images that are going to affect public consciousness. And those, that's almost like a cartooning process when they manufacture these false flags.
I totally agree with you. And I think when they have these staff meetings, when they plan these things, I've got this confirmed by Chip Tatum, the CIA whistleblower, that they're actual like normal meetings, staff meetings, when they go through the whole thing before and right after the event, just to check that they got the desired effect from the event, or if they need follow-up events as well. So in these staff meetings, for sure, they have these storyboards. The whole timeline is set how to carry them out. And I would suggest that on this Copenhagen thing, it's almost like they've taken it to the next level, because if you see historically wise, this is exactly 70 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. It's also 70 years, very shortly now, the end of the Second World War and the liberation of Denmark, Norway, all of these countries that was under occupation, and so on. And it's like this is, I think they're going for the emotional impact once again, the problem, reaction, solution template. And the emotion this time is for us to feel sorry for the Jewish population and blame someone else. Get the pressure away from the state of Israel. This is my interpretation. And put the blame somewhere else so that they can continue with what they're doing. So one of the things also when they carry these things out, they're very much into numerology and numbers and dates and so on. And just a few days before the event happened in Denmark, on the 9th of February, one of the major newspapers in Denmark called Politiken had the front page of that newspaper. I think about 30% of the whole front picture of this was the number 666 in red on a black background. These 666 had nothing really to do with the article underneath it. And then on top of it, there are two staring eyes, you know, the all-seeing eyes. They always love the pyramid, the all-seeing eyes, the numbers, the radioactive sign and these things. And here we got everything in the same front page. The 666, massively big, then the all-seeing eyes on top of that, and then to the right of the eyes, there's a pyramid-shaped form with a radioactive sign inside it, and then to the left of it, it says, "Let the people draw the prophet the way they want."
Wow, that's crazy. So what was the excuse for the 666? Was there some story that was supposedly illustrating? I mean, how could it be totally random and unconnected to everything else on the front page? Wouldn't people kind of freak out about that?
No, it says that 666, and then it says underneath, millions were hidden in Swiss bank accounts.
Oh, 666 million were hidden in Swiss bank accounts?
Yeah, that's
oh,
what it
goodness.
Says. But the numbers are just, I'm going to send it to you so you can publish it. It's just, it's so big, massive, massive. And this is leaked out 5 days before. And then the same 666 recurs in a cartoon inside the newspaper some days later, but before the thing happens. And it's a very strange cartoon, because normally a cartoon is funny. This is not funny at all. This man behind a desk reading the newspaper where it says 666 on it, and the 666 is not made by hand. It's a photo of this front page, and then next to him, there's somebody standing with glasses. He looks like a politician, and in between them, there's like a dragon with goat's horns, and then there's a quote from the Bible talking about the beast, you know?
Wow. So they're basically advertising for the Antichrist, which appears to be the Zionist false flaggers. And they're proud of it. They're putting it right out there in the open.
Kevin, this is my interpretation of it. I mean, I can, it's difficult for me not to interpret it in any other way. Then once we've gone through the shooting, there were three different events. There was first the attack on this cultural cafe where a man was shot dead. Absolutely not the one they say was the target, this Swedish cartoonist, but actually a Danish filmmaker. And he's not mentioned at all, even though he's the one that was killed there. So the police does not look into him being a target whatsoever. They just totally focus on this was a free speeching event, and this was why Denmark and the freedom of speech has been attacked. I would say, I'm not sure, no disrespect to this family, to the family of the victim or something, but when it comes to these false flags, you never know for sure, did anyone actually get killed or not? I think if this man got killed, then it was because he was outside the cafe and he started to interfere with the people carrying it out, and that is why he was eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And it's also possible, of course, that the whole thing was staged, and, you know, if you looked into the biography of the guy who was killed, who knows what you might find. But as you said, it also just could be a random thing.
I know for sure that he made three different documentaries. But then you have the shooter, the witnesses saw two shooters. This goes into one shooter that gets away, not being followed. And then he hijacks a car. They do not interview the driver. In some newspaper it says she was female. Others says it was a man. But there's no interviews with the driver saying, what did the guy look like? Did he carry a weapon? Was it the same guy? Nothing like that. He just grabs the car, takes off. And also one thing to point out is, as far as I've been able to sort, in Denmark there are two main TV channels, DK1, DR1 and DR2, and none of these channels was filming live from the event until about 1 hour after it occurred.
So they were a little bit slow to get there,
to say the least. But this is also standard in many of these false flag operations, that everything slows down. It's almost on standby until everything is carried out, everybody involved is out of the way, and then boom, in they go. So I find that very suspicious, because there were helicopters circling in the area, but no news media.
Hmm, interesting.
Anyway, the guy disappears, and then he turns up again at 1 a.m. in the morning outside a synagogue, where it's said that he pretends to be drunk. There are two armed police guards and a Jewish guard. He walks by them pretending like to be drunk, then returns and goes up to the Jewish guard and suddenly just pulls a gun and gives him a headshot. Then he shoots and injures both the police officers and runs away. both the weapons of the police officer, both of them were defect, did not work. I find that highly strange as well.
Wait, we're told that the weapons jammed or something? That the police officers tried to use their weapons, but they didn't work?
That is the police's own version. The police's own version, not mine. Then, when you look at this synagogue, this is the center of the Jewish population, of the Jewish faith in Denmark, sort of. So if you would hit to make an emotional impact, that where you would hit, you know.
Wow, that's just like the Charlie Hebdo guys switching their getaway car right in the exact center of Jewish Paris.
There you go. Here we are, and in 1985, there was a similar attack carried out by Palestinians, it said, against the synagogue with a bomb, but it didn't go off. Instead, Northwest Orient, I think that's what the American airline is called, their office was blown up in Denmark. And later, I think three Palestinians were sentenced to prison terms for these things. But so the synagogue is the place. But if I can take you to the Boston bombing, if you go down there, you Google map yourself down to the exact address where the bombs went off, and you look at the street, you're standing looking at the pavement where the bombs were. If you do a 180 turn, you turn around and you're looking straight into the entrance of the public library in Boston. I would say this is also where the Boston Globe went out a few minutes before the bombs went off, saying there's going to be a bomb drill outside the library.
Right.
My opinion is that the library is where the whole thing was carried out from. That was the center, because they need somewhere that normal people can they won't notice and they won't see in, you know. It was on Patriots Day when the bombs went off in Boston. And people, I think that they use the library because they need the logistics like coffee, food, toilets, makeup, place for explosives, the electronic equipment, all of these things, extras, and so on, to be prepared so that, boom, when it goes off, everybody can just run out, do their things, and then go back inside. Nobody notices. And then you clean it up. Monday morning, you open up. Nobody would ever notice what had happened. And if you go back to Copenhagen, you go to the synagogue, which is located in a very narrow back street. You look at the synagogue, you do a 180, you turn around, and you look straight into the entrance of the Copenhagen main library. I would very much suggest that is possibly where the commander center for this whole operation was carried out.
Very interesting. So it might be interesting to look at the records for both the Boston and Copenhagen libraries and see if there are any nonprofit groups that rented a room or anything like that. Or were there repairs going on? The part of the library was supposedly shut off. It might be interesting to take a look at that.
Very much so. And I took a group there. I went straight to the terror site in Denmark. I was met up with a group of interested people, and I did a whole day's walk around these sites. And when we were standing exactly there, one of the guys went in to use the bathroom. And he came out afterward and said, "You won't believe what I just saw." He took me in and he showed me in one of the bathrooms, somebody had drawn very beautifully, very beautiful handwriting, 666, Satan loves you, and an upside down cross. So the exact same message I was in the newspaper were in the bathrooms. Could be a coincidence. I don't know. I'm just pointing it out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. Wow. Well, how about the white bus evacuation issue in Copenhagen?
Yep. Exactly. Do you know, when you go to before the Second World War, there was one night when Hitler's supporters went totally berserk and they went around smashing up synagogues and Jewish homes and so on. It went under the name of Kristallnacht because of all the broken glass in the street and so on. Well, this synagogue is located on Crystal Street in Copenhagen. Once again, just pointing it out. And there was a film crew that came about an hour or so after the shooting. They were and the police had closed off the street and so on. And this film crew just filmed this massive big white bus trying to make its way down this road going against traffic. And on the front of it, it's white. And on the front top of it, it says evacuation. This is also hand painted beautifully on the side of the bus. Because, you know, on the top of the bus, you can do it, just digitally change whatever name of the station you're going to. But this thing on the side of it has to been done, you know, with great care, because it looks beautiful on the side. And I would suggest that this is a PSYOP, once again, part of the PSYOP, because just before the end of the Second World War, there was a Swedish man that is now a legend. His name was Raoul Wallenberg. And what he managed to do was negotiate with the Nazis to release some of their prisoners from the concentration camps and so on. And in the end, he went down with a whole motor cage of buses. I can't remember how many buses, but white buses with the Red Cross in the front of them. They went around to different, Auschwitz and Sachsenhausen, I think it was, and other concentration camps, and picked up many, many of the Jewish prisoners and then took them to Scandinavia. This is like legendary in Scandinavia, what he did. And here we have...
Wow, the white evacuation buses from the concentration camps.
Yeah.
Wow.
And here we have the exact same color of a bus with a strange cross in the front of it. It looks like a blue cross, but with... instead of two lines across, there's like eight across. So I haven't been able to find what that symbol is for. But so here, that bus, I've seen that also during the day after the first shooting. So that was in central Copenhagen there. And I believe maybe they used the bus to bring the team with the equipment from one side to the other, or it was just there to do the PSYOP, you know, play with people's minds.
Well, yeah, it would remind people of the evacuation of Jews from the concentration camps, which is, of course, apparently one of the purposes of Charlie Hebdo and the Copenhagen shooting, to force the evacuation of Jews from Europe and send them to Israel.
Because this is exactly the same word as Netanyahu was using after both the Paris and the Copenhagen thing. We need to evacuate. That was the word he used. That was the word on the bus.
Wow. You know, and this idea that the bus is painted with a big fancy evacuation sign on it reminds me a lot of the way they painted a truck in New York City on 9/11 with a mural of planes diving into the World Trade Center. That was, if you go online, you can actually find a copy of the police radio in which the police have caught these Israelis who were driving a truck full of explosives, and on the side of the truck was painted a mural of planes or a plane diving into the World Trade Center. So it's this idea of painting your vehicles in a kind of a PSYOP way to play with people appears to have happened on 9/11 as well as in Copenhagen.
You had the 7/7 bombings in London as well, where the advertisement on the bus as well was part of the PSYOP.
What was that advertisement in London?
I can't remember it right now. I can just remember. I'm going to look into it until the next time we speak, and okay, I'll tell you. But okay, I remember on the bus there as well, you had this thing. So nothing new under the sun. They just repeated, and I think this one they pulled it, taken to the next level. Also, there was an image of this white bus being tweeted around, and then it says the armed forces arriving. But armed forces, you wouldn't say that in Denmark. You would say the police are coming or military people. But the armed forces, I would say, once again, it's a referral to the Second World War, the whole thing, because this is the way they play our minds.
Very interesting. Wow. Well, so you've been exposing this. You've been right on top of it from the get-go, pretty much. Well, in fact, you were right on top of it a month before it happened. and now you've been touring, both doing speaking gigs about this and then also going on site and investigating. So tell us a little bit about your travels during the past, what's it been now, like about a little over a month since this happened?
Yeah, it happened on the 14th and 15th. Yeah, I was there a week ago or so, and it was a little bit, how shall I say, it's always a bit scary when you put your head right into the behave, because this is an ongoing event, and they the forces behind this, the last thing they want is to get it exposed. So when I got there, I was a little bit nervous, I must say, because, well, you never know what's going to happen. And when we came there, it was me and and my friend Frank, who's the brain behind the Open Mind Conference in Denmark. And we went there, and there were like, I think, 2, 3, 4 police vehicles on site, you know, outside the cafe. There were people with automatic weapons and uniforms. And they were sort of standing around, I think, waiting for us because this had been advertised and so on. But the thing is, these situations, I think, is I really love them, I must say, because if you enter them without aggression, without anger, without anything on that, but just keep your mind in a loving space, you know, not see an enemy, see a brother in uniform and so on, it diffuses. And once again, here we came, totally open, smiling, warm. They were expecting a confrontation, instead we came. And the officer approached us, and I could see after a while, he was the nervous one, where it should have been the other way around. And in the end, it ended with him giving his business card to us, saying, if you need any help and assistance, here's my number, just give me a call, and so on. So it was great in that case, in that way.
Yeah. Okay. And how about the people there in Copenhagen? I'm sure there's a small community, at least, of people who are aware of false flags. Are they active in investigating this?
A small group, yes, very, very active. But the main people have absolutely no idea. So this is why I've been in Danish media and so on, not alternative media. It's getting to a point where it's being more, I'm being invited to bigger things. But also I'm a little aware of that because, you know, if one of the big ones, I've been invited before, they to you for like 25 minutes and then they cut it down to 7 seconds and it makes you look really stupid. So
yeah, that's what they always do. It's one reason I actually prefer the live broadcasts, like when I was fighting with Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity in 2006 and 2007, the live broadcasts were always better because if you let them tape it, as you said, they're going to just try to stitch together something very brief to make you look bad. And so when people do those pre-recorded interviews with the mainstream, they're very smart to make sure that the whole thing gets filmed by their side as well as by the mainstream. So you have a complete record of everything that happened. And then that way you could always at least post that on YouTube and show how they distorted the interview.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree. But I just want to, if we can continue a little bit more with the end of this thing in Denmark.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because the thing was, 5 o'clock in the morning, the police says that this guy came walking. They had stalked this address, and when he came, they said, "Show us your hands." They shouted to him, and the official story, according to the police, is that he pulled out 2 pistols and started shooting from the hip, you know, like Billy the Kid style, at these 2 police officers, and then they had to shoot him in self-defense.
It always seems to work that way. They always seem to shoot down the Oswald or whoever it is.
But do you know how many shots they shot him with? They shot him with 38 shots.
Wow, they really didn't want this guy to survive to talk, did they?
So you look at the crime scene, it's been very well filmed. Not afterwards, the guy is lying outside the entrance to this apartment building. He's dead in the on the pavement and so on. You look at him. This is a guy who's been shot 38 times. Absolutely no blood in the street whatsoever. Then there are no bullet holes in the wall, so they must have been extremely good shots. So, of course, then what happened? Well, the police said that he had a bulletproof vest on. That's why they had to shoot 38 times. But then, of course, was he killed by a shot in this big toe, or where was he hit? I mean, then he must have been hit in the head to die. But absolutely no head wounds, no blood, no nothing. I've been on site as well. I checked the whole facade. There's no bullet holes whatsoever, except in the door. There are 3 And the door is made of wood, so very easy to make holes in that one. So you look at the vehicle where the police were said to be inside. The side window is smashed, because the guy was shooting at them. So, of course, the glass would be inside the vehicle. No, it's on the outside in the street. And, of course, the bullet had passed through the car, so the windows on the other side were smashed, or there were holes in the doors and so on. Absolutely not. So here we are again. Did this guy die for real? Did he exist? Was this a made-up? I don't know. I checked his name. And, when I do interviews about these false flags, one of the things I say, they always want to try and find a Muslim terrorist, and his name would be something like Abdul Karim Karumkara, to make him sound strange and exotic, foreign, dangerous, these type of things. Well, this guy who was born in Denmark, his name was Omar Hamid Abdel El Hussein. That is not a very Danish name, I tell you. I checked the phone books. I checked everything. I cannot find this guy. This guy does not appear anywhere. And then you see the people they interview in the street, that saw him, and they said, well, blah, 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 blah. It must have been a lone crazy guy. There's two of the witnesses they interview that mention the word lone crazy guy right there on site. I would put a very big question mark around these so-called witnesses.
The lone nut syndrome.
Another thing, how can they say a thing like that? They're just bystanders.
Sounds like Harley guy at the World Trade Center. The guy on his Harley, yep, who just kind of smiles and reads obviously scripted lines that, the fires must have been just too hot, causing the building to collapse.
I mean, that is quite an amazing observation, I would say, just minutes afterwards.
Wow.
And... well, then then you see, in my opinion, it's quite obvious that this is a staged event. So the big question is, why? Because this is the most important thing, is either we're looking at a group of extreme Muslim terrorists that are going berserk on a global scale, or we're looking at a global enemy from within that are staging these things for a totally different agenda. And I would say, if we can say that, okay, this was yet another false flag, then who are the ones that we have to look at? And here we have Netanyahu coming forward right away. He's also saying to the Jewish population, please understand that these attacks will continue. How does he know that? If he's not involved in them,
well, he's the one who threatened France. He said that France will have terrorist attacks if it continues to side with the Palestinians.
Maybe he's psychic. I don't know. I would say that I would very much get Netanyahu to look himself in the mirror and come forward and say what's going on, because he is definitely so extremely involved in this whole thing.
Well, if he loses the Israeli elections and goes back to being a furniture salesman, maybe we can go down and make a citizen's arrest at the furniture store.
Yeah, but also the Danish government is very much involved with this as well, because one of the things you see with these false flags is there's a lot of things on standby. For instance, the shootings happen in Paris. Boom, you had all of these posters with the slogan, the Charlie Hebdo slogan, Je suis Charlie or whatever. All of them printed on black paper with a white font. All of them identical font. How did that happen? I would say it's there on standby being given out, In Denmark, loads of people came into the streets. All of them had torches, identical as far as I've been able to check out. So we're looking at maybe 30,000 torches.
Torches in the British sense of flashlights, electric?
More like candles. Type of things.
Okay, so that somebody handed out tens of thousands of identical candles.
Yeah, and these were, as far as I've been able to find out, given out for free. So who was handing them out? These are the signs also of false flag, to get the whole thing going, to create this whole scene for a maximum impact emotionally on the population.
So we need to find out who placed the order for the hundreds of thousands of Je suis Charlie signs in exactly the same fonts. We need to see who placed the order for these tens of thousands of candles that showed up immediately after this event in Denmark. Maybe that's a clue as to who was really behind it.
But also then you have the Danish prime minister. She said, right after this thing happened in Paris, she said that, oh my God, we have to see this as an attack on Denmark. How can something in Paris be an attack on Denmark? But that is the exact words that she said.
She's an attack on free.
it's incredible. And then when this thing happened in Denmark, they said, this is an attack on Denmark and its Jewish population. We have to stand up as one unit and defend the freedom of speech. Okay, so she included the word of the Jewish population together with Denmark. So an attack on Denmark. And then within a few days after this happened, they presented a budget where it said, we have put forward, I think it was 1 billion Danish kroner. I mean, this is a massive amount of money for new anti-terrorist things, you know, for you to, so they can dig even deeper into your computer, more surveillance cameras, more bodyguards, more all of these things. 1 billion, that was only a few days after. And then the next thing came saying that Denmark is going to be the host of the next anti-terror international meeting.
Wow. So the usual, probably the same people that pulled this thing off will be back at that meeting doing closed sessions. Wow.
Totally, totally.
Well, you know, Ole, we're about at the end of our half hour here, so why don't we sum it up and give the listeners your website?
My website is lightonconspiracies.com, lightonconspiracies.com. I've got the newsletter membership, my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion. If anybody wants to support me, I'm greatly, greatly grateful for it. I really, really appreciate it because that's the way I can continue this type of research.
Well, that's right. We're not getting any corporate money. We're not getting foundation money. Ford Foundation, for some reason, doesn't want to support this kind of investigation. So, yeah, people should go to Light on Conspiracies and help Ole out if you can. I'm Kevin Barrett. My website is truthjihad.com, and help is always welcome there as well. Back soon with the second half of the show. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, exposing lies of the empire on a regular basis. And we're going to be talking about that in the second half of today's show with Andrei Volchek, whose new book happens to have that title, Exposing Lies of the Empire. Andrei Volchek has been doing that for quite some time. He pretty much travels nonstop all over the world. And everywhere he goes, he discovers the evils being done by this bankster Western empire that uses the American military as its mafia enforcement arm. And Andre, I think, is doing some of the best, most hard-hitting work in this. He's a filmmaker as well as a print journalist or internet print journalist, whatever you call that these days. And he's now in Paris, France. C'est très bien, Paris, parmi mes villes préférées. I lived in Paris when in 88, 89, and I wish I could be over there with him. So, hey, let's bring it on. Welcome, Andrei Volchek. How are you?
Kevin, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, it's always good to have you back. It's every time I talk to you, you're probably, you know, thousands of miles away from where you were the last time. What brings you to Paris?
Well, I'm visiting Italy, France, Germany, and Czech Republic because I have so many books now, and actually translations of my books. One with Noam Chomsky, one on Indonesia, and my latest books, Fighting Against Western Imperialism, and this one, which you just mentioned, which is 822-page monster, Exposing Lies of the Empire. So I'm meeting publishers, translators, and also filmmakers, because I'm workaholic. I'm working all the time, day and night, actually fighting the empire. So France is... Well, not the best place to be these days, but it's Paris is still one of the major cities with plenty of publishing houses and all this. So I'm visiting France, and then I'm going to Czech Republic, where they just translated my book with Chomsky. and also Germany, where they translated and will publish in May my book on fascist Indonesian state, Indonesia archipelago of fear. But actually, Kevin, today, before I came back to the hotel to talk to you, I visited Charlie area for what used to be Charlie Magazine, but it's still Charlie Hebdo Magazine. It's still there. I just went there to see what's going on around there. There is a heavy police presence with a lot of people with machine guns now, and a lot of statements about freedom and about democracy and all this.
So yeah, I'm surprised they didn't arrest you and you're not sharing a cell with Dieudonné and those other dozens or maybe it's hundreds of people by now that they rounded up for crimes of free speech after Charlie Hebdo. You know, they said we're going to war to protect your free speech, and then they started arresting people for free speech.
Yes, but I saw something very interesting, because you know me, I'm a philosopher. I don't just go to Charlie Hebdo magazine. I go all around. So after Charlie Hebdo's magazine, I went where they have all these roses and all these statements and everything. I went to National Archives of France, and they are very close to that, maybe 15 minutes walk. And the National Archives, which is, you know, it's a monster. It's a tremendous kind of ensemble of buildings and parks and gardens and everything. They have very interesting exhibition, and the exhibition deals with France collaborating with Nazi Germany during the Second World War, and it's actually a very brave exhibition. You know, there is a
they like to imagine that they were all in the Resistance, but not true. Hardly anybody was in the Resistance.
But I was actually very impressed, because there was a huge, huge portrait of Hitler and Pétain and. You know, there are all imaginable photos and posters and films showing how French were collaborating during the Second World War with the Nazis, including the posters that were showing the last big crusade. And there is this fascist symbol and French, Italian, German flags waving and all this. You cannot photograph it. It's forbidden. I did, of course. So I was thinking.
Really? And they didn't throw you in jail with Dieudonné?
Look, I mean, I have like
I don't know how you do it. You know, I'm really amazed that you managed to remain free, wandering around the world.
I mean, look, you cannot photograph anything in France these days. I mean, I was once almost arrested for photographing a skating rink in front of the mayor's house.
Really? That's terrible. When I lived there in 88, 89, I was photographing everything.
Well, it changed, but let me get back to the point. I mean, tried to engage people at that exhibition whether France is not actually collaborating again, and whether in some 50 or 60 years they are not going to do the same exhibition, you know, showing how they were collaborating with the empire.
Actually
pushing. They were actually, you know what is funny in Europe? I already noticed this in Italy. People are actually very scared to talk. They, you know, they think you are a provocateur if you ask these kind of questions. You know, like 20 years ago, they would give you a hug and they would take you for a beer or for a glass of wine and you would talk the whole night. Now, they look at you like if you're some kind of a horrible provocateur and agent of I don't know what.
You must be working for ISIS.
Or ISIS, yeah, well, or CIA or ISIS or whatever. I mean, I had the same thing. I was in Guggenheim in Venice, and I was kind of challenged one of the curators, and I was asking her about Pollock's exhibition. I said, don't you know Pollock worked for the CIA, and he was kind of implanted to Europe to screw the art and put form over substance? And she was really trying to run away from me. Anyway, so I tried to talk to people in the National Archives. They were not very communicative. But I think after this Charlie Hebdo, this National Archive, the logical place to continue was this ocean of art galleries that are around National Archives. You know, you have a big museum of Picasso there, and you have maybe 40, 50, 60 important galleries. Well, what did I find out? Of course, these galleries are showing absolute crap. There is no political art whatsoever. You could see a pink poodle, you know, on the golden leash. I went to the bar to eat a steak. There was a dog. I never saw such a dog. It looked like a cow. It was enormous. So the dog came with the owner, put its paws on the bar and had a beer. So the owner had a beer and they ordered for a dog, like some kind of a plate with the beer. And
that's hilarious. The French are kind of weird with their dogs.
It put the front paws on the bar.
When I was in France, Andre, this is kind of an aside. I did an art exhibition. I took double exposed photographs at the Pet Cemetery out on, I think it was at the Ile d'Orléans or something. And then the butcher shops, which were incredibly beautifully decorated. So I did double exposures of Pet Cemetery and meat in the butcher shops and called it Pet Cemetery Meat as a sort of a commentary on that aspect of French culture.
Yeah, but the bloody dog, you know, it downs the beer and goes to, you know, almost ate my steak. And, you know, I live in Asia most of the time. I mean, I never see such a things there. I mean, it sounds...
Yeah. People in the Islamic world think that's weird, too.
Well, it's like an Airbus 380, you know, comes to you and wants to eat your steak, you know. Anyway, so after that, I went to the galleries and I realized, what are they fighting for? I mean, it's like you are at the Charlie Hebdo's magazine. All around there, it's all this freedom. We are not going to let them take our liberty and all this. And then you go to their galleries and they show total crap. Yeah. There is nothing.
If you want good political art, you got to go to Tehran. You should have seen some of the Palestine art I saw in Tehran.
Of course, Tehran, Beijing, Cuba. There you see political art, Russia. But, you know, that I want to actually write an essay, a philosophic essay exactly on this. Why, what is actually all this free? All that they are exhibiting here in Paris, 99.9%. could easily pass in North Korea. You know, the style is the quality of painting is a bit better here, but in North Korea they have a little bit more enthusiasm and optimism. At least they have paintings on building the country.
Well, talk about the decline and fall of French culture. They're behind North Korea now in visual art. That's a pretty major decline.
Definitely. I mean, what's there to censor? I mean, it's all that they put to these galleries would pass any censorship anywhere. It would pass maybe even censorship in, I don't know, definitely Pakistan or Indonesia, or in Iran. There is nothing to censor. So what are they talking about? So the only criticism you can see maybe are in these magazines like Charlie Hebdo criticizing Islam or criticizing somebody else. You know,
they have one genius political artist, and that's Jidone, the comedian, and they keep arresting him.
But these are exceptions. This is exactly 0.01% of the artists that actually make some sense. So, you know, I come to Paris maybe three times a year, and I go to London and everywhere in Germany. Whenever I come to Europe, I actually go out of my way to go to all these galleries, to avant-garde galleries. And, you know, I work a lot in 798 in Beijing, which is very political neighborhood of artists, maybe 200-300 avant-garde galleries. It's all political. Well, not all, but maybe 40-50%. Shanghai, definitely. Cuba, definitely. Venezuela, definitely. They're chewing each other. They're fighting each other. And that's what art is supposed to be. You go anywhere, in New York, in London, in Stuttgart, in Paris, in Venice, it's absolutely... You know, in Venice, again, I went back at some meetings and I was photographing also. I talked to some curators. It's like Bali in Indonesia, you know. I mean, it's basically like they just make what sells.
Yeah, they sell to tourists, right?
Exactly. It's declining to that level.
Yeah, that's like the T-shirt art at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco's tourist district. Call that art? I don't know.
Exactly. And you go to these new galleries in Venice, and they are actually becoming, you know, they are now, they're chains. Art gallery chains, and you look at it, and it's like this squashed buildings, twisted buildings. I'm thinking, where did I see this crap? Oh, I saw it in somewhere in Tallinn, in Estonia. You know, it's all the same wherever you go. So there is nothing And in the meantime, you know, Europe is going down the drain. In Lido, in Venice, they had electric shortcuts, blackout, things are late. It's really bad mood all over the place. And there is nothing of this reflected in the art. This is pathetic. So I'm going to connect this. I'm going to connect this freedom speeches at the Charlie Hebdo and with this collaboration of friendship during the Second World War, an absolute emptiness of their modern art.
Excellent. You know, your contribution to this "We Are Not Charlie Hebdo" book is very nice, and so you know that book's going to be coming out soon.
Yeah,
I'm really glad you're in. It sounds like maybe that we might even have something else to add if this new piece is also about Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, but it's going to be a combination of Charlie Hebdo and what it really means freedom now for Europeans. Because it's becoming very abstract term. It's almost like it's us the greatest, and that's the freedom. We are great because we are free, and we are free because we are great. But there is not really any substance to back it up by their creations. I mean, where is their Picasso, actually? Where is their Goya? Even Delacroix. I don't know where are these people now, but I definitely don't see them in any commercial galleries, and I don't see them in established museums.
Now, I think we're seeing a cultural decline of Western civilization in general, and I think we see it in the decline of the kind of political art you're talking about, which was largely the product of the secularization of the West. And, you know, every culture kind of has rise and falls. The religious side of the West sort of fell a couple of centuries ago, and then this secular side rose, and there's been a lot of very interesting creative work produced by it. But now I think that sort of run its course, and one of the reasons that they're lashing out against Islam is it's a culture that still has its religious core, and the Western secular culture has lost its reason for being. It's lost its élan, and its élan vital, the vital spirit, and so now it has nothing left to do but sort of lash out at Islam and pretend that that's some kind of great forward progress.
Exactly. I have all these chapters in my book, Exposing Lies of the Empire, about Islam, how it is demonized and how the West actually created, manufactured radical Islamist movements. But also I have chapters on the European art, how cowardly it actually is and how cowardly it was for centuries, never standing for oppressed people, never standing for colonized people, never protesting against the Crusades. It was basically European art is religious art. It's only modern art went sexual and went decorative, but it was mainly just the glorification of Christian religion and glorification of aristocracy and rich merchants. So
of course it was very good at what it did. You know, it's a very impressive body of work, let's face it. Even if you don't like
but
what it did.
But it's very one-sided, kind of.
Of course.
There is nothing political. I'm writing a lot about this. In the book, in Exposing Lies of the Empire, I have chapters which are dealing actually with this, comparing modern Chinese art and the Western art and Latin American art. I'm actually writing, there is one chapter strictly on how the revolutions in Latin America succeeded mainly because of the art, because of the music, because of the poetry, because of literature, because of visual arts. Actually, art radicalized Latin American societies. The films, theaters is where things were discussed, where the philosophy of the American colonialism and European colonialism was discussed. Music and poetry is where people got radicalized in a positive way to go to the barricades to fight for a better world and all this. So, and I'm writing about how obviously West learned about this and how they are trying for decades to actually neutralize the art or castrate it and make it totally apolitical.
You know, that's a really interesting point. You know, seeing it sort of from the two perspectives, from the sort of top-down perspective, the, you know, the classical art critics might say that the sort of aristocratic model produces better art, quote-unquote, in that it sifts through all of the productions and gets to the people who are really technically good or have an amazing vision, and then they get to work for the aristocracy, whereas popular art typically is much more sort of free-form and everybody's doing it, whether or not they're super talented. But then there's the other side of it, which is that popular art empowers the people. You know, if everybody's out there reading poetry and a lot of people are doing it, then they're actually getting some power over their lives by being able to re-envision life themselves. And that, I think, is a huge part of this kind of cutting-edge political revolutionary culture that you're talking about. I saw it in Tehran, Andre. You know, you should see Tehran. I was wandering through this beautiful, huge park next to the hotel I was staying at in central Tehran. And this park is just a gorgeous, you know, it's a series of Persian gardens with the water trickling down in these beautiful shapes and forms. And the place was full. It was Friday afternoon after the prayers. Everybody was out there in the park with their families playing frisbee or barbecuing or playing all of these different games. They have ping pong tables set up. They have tetherball courts or volleyball courts, all sorts of fun. Everybody's having fun out in this beautiful park. I'm wandering through the park and I come upon these art exhibitions. There's an art exhibition about their war against Iraq that had all kinds of amazing sculptures. It looked like they recreated one of the key battlefields of that war. Then they had a Palestine art show in a pavilion that was just fantastic stuff. They had Palestine cartoon contests, so they had all sorts of great submissions of art and cartoons supporting the Palestinian struggle. This was so cool. It was so much better than anything you would ever find anywhere in the United States, both in terms of life for ordinary people and in terms of the living quality of the art. So I'm with you. I think there's something really important about this this topic.
But also what you mentioned before about aristocratic art and the people's art, I think that in particularly places like Latin America and Russia and China, but most likely in Iran, now it's a fusion. It's not just one or the other, because some of the greatest artists in Latin America, even Siqueiros or Diego Rivera or Frida Kahlo, that they tried to popularize Frida Kahlo, but she was a revolutionary artist. These people were great artists. I mean, that's true. they were great muralists. They were great. Some of the poets of Latin America had Nobel Prize for literature, like Pablo Neruda or Gabriela Mistral. So it's not only people's art. You have both. I mean, Eduardo Galeano is a great. Is one of the greatest storytellers in the world. So you have all sorts of things, and there the artists are listening to the people. You know, they go to the roots. They listen to the stories. They go. They are not. In the West, it's all most of it now. It's me, and it's either form or it's their fear of losing erections or, you know, getting old and being alone. And it's all about themselves. You know, there is nothing. It's all personal.
That's a good point. Iranian film is an example of, you know, there are great artists working in Iranian film.
One of the best in the world, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Iran redefined neorealism, Italian neorealism in the cinema, and it's in many ways they improved it. I mean, it's down to the basics. It's powerful and it is entertaining. It's not boring at all. It's tremendously human.
That's right. It's a great relief from Hollywood, and that's why one reason why it's great to have Iran also having these anti-Hollywoodism conferences, which I've attended. Is that ironic, though, that, you know, we're told that Iran is this totally just oppressive theocracy, you know, where they crush everybody's aspirations to be free and creative, and yet they've got a lot better art, at least as far as I can tell, than the empire does.
Of course they do. And also the discussion in Iran, I have, it's one of the few countries I haven't been to. I keep being invited there. I have to go there soon. But they interview me, you know, Press TV interviews me, and also the Tehran Times interview me. And basically the same what Chomsky said when we were writing our book, that we can get away with many more things in Iran. when we get on their television or on the or if the newspaper interviews us, then we get away in the West. So, like, for instance, this latest book of mine, it's very provocative, but it's very provocative from the Western point of view, from the point of view of the readers. But I'm sure if it's going to be translated to Farsi, they will just find it quite natural what I write about.
Well, that's right, yeah. And I'm sure there are, you know, there are all sorts of differences of opinion within Iran's establishment, both the sort of the more secular side and the clerical side. It's amazing, the variety of views that I discovered just by, you know, talking with different clerics over there, different views from each other. It's amazing that they all managed to, you know, keep it together. But they,
well, it's one of the biggest cultures in the world also.
Yeah, that's sure. And we never hear about any of that here. Well, that's why we have to send people like you out around the world to find out what's really going on. Well, Andre, I think we've hit about the end of our allotted slot. Once again, okay. Tell us about your new book.
Well, it's 820 pages, 3 years of my investigations, both as a journalist and as a philosopher, trying to explain how the empire is actually destroying everything that it's on its way to total domination, and also how it creates all these so-called opposition and color and umbrella, you name it, movements. So I travel to all these places that are battered by the West. I wrote from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Hong Kong, from Thailand, Eritrea, Zimbabwe, you name it. So this is a result. It's my biggest book so far, and it was supposed to be 1,000 pages, but the printer didn't want to take it, so the font had to be reduced. But it is actually 1,000-page book of all that I think one has to know about the empire's evil intentions to move of its way and to destroy every free and independent movement or country or government that stands on its way.
Okay, well, that's the brand new book, Exposing Lies of the Empire. Andre Volchek, the website is AndreVolchek.com, is that right? Both first and last name. And we'll link that at the Truth Jihad Radio blog. Just go to TruthJihad.com and click on the radio link. Well, thank you so much, Andre Volchek. Passe un bon séjour à Paris. Have a good time in Paris. And look forward to our next conversation from wherever the heck you end up.
Well, don't forget, I'm your roaming correspondent.
You are. You're the roving Truth Jihad Radio correspondent. Who knows where he's roving to next, but look forward to that next conversation wherever you end up. All right, take care, Andre.
Okay, Kevin, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Always good to have you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.